Hi, Adam here to tell you what you're about to listen to. This is a campaign retrospective for all of Nightfall. It's sort of like a Dice Peaks for the entire campaign. And like a Dice Peaks, we get progressively punchier, some of us get progressively drunker, and our topics range far and wide. On my end, this was actually recorded in our elusive sysadmin and tech wizard's house, so I actually got Philip to record a little something for us that I'll just drop in here.
I told you I'm not doing that, Adam.
Thanks, Philip. You do so much for us behind the scenes that it's nice to have you on the mic at last. Along with the show, I hope you enjoy this campaign retrospective for all of Nightfall. Hello and welcome to Dicebox, a tabletop role-playing podcast where we focus on playing full campaigns and less well-known systems. This week in our Nightfall Campaigns retrospective episode, our players and myself discuss, question, answer, and reminisce about the last half hundred and more episodes of Reign and Nobilis shenanigans. Hello and welcome. I'm Adam, your friendly neighborhood game master, and joining me are...
Hey, I'm Drew, and you may know me as well as Dosk pre-ascension and Leorian post-things getting especially weird.
Hi, I'm Robin, formerly Fury, formerly Lissa.
I'm Dez, and I was Romnet. Murder. Truth. Darkness.
Excellent. Thank you.
And in the game.
Forget the forge.
That's a wow, you are out of Lissa mode.
Yeah.
I was going to say, yeah, Lissa wouldn't have, but Robin, well, you know.
Yeah.
Lissa wouldn't do that, but Robin might.
it's you know, getting ever smaller in the rearview mirror, but thank you all. So before we get started, let me briefly recap our recently completed campaign for ourselves and our listeners. We started with everybody arriving in Fermata, by which I mean Romnet was already there, but he wasn't a nobilis. Dosk and Lissa were recently ennobled and arrived in the city. They got, at first, a small variety of odd jobs, met some people, some of whom would be important, others of whom I would struggle to make relevant for the rest of the campaign. Before too long, they were dispatched to first Calavin, where they had an encounter with the Deep, and then later to Diamacor, where they encountered Nyx, and more importantly, Apatia. Returning, they got involved in the larger-scale shenanigans of the War Between the Gods. And it wasn't too long before Romnet was ennobled, and then later Dosk ascended to godhood, and later still, our players switched allegiances from Mott to Dosk, aided, of course, by the fact that Mott got murdered. Having encountered Celiand and her nobilis, it was only a matter of time before a confrontation between them arose, and our player characters became resolved to not complete the war, but rather to sort of abrogate its causes. And that is what was done towards the end, ushering in a new age of diffuse divinity and more mortal agency. So I don't think I left
war to end, if not all wars, then certainly all gods.
Indeed. And I don't think I left anything out. I think that was every detail you could possibly want in the entire campaign. So now that we're on the same page, does anyone have any personal character growth they'd like to share?
Why couldn't you have made me secrets, Adam?
Because I could not have GM'd it. Any other questions?
There are limits to even, yeah, right? There are limits even to the Hollyhock God's power. It's been admitted. There is a rock so heavy that if he created it, he could not lift it.
This is why I didn't create it. Problem
and
solved.
It is apparently me in charge of secrets. Which, to be fair, he's seen me play spy type characters before. Yeah,
well, and if they're mortal and have limits, then it's one thing. But yeah, so for our players and listeners, and as Des has just indicated, I picture this being a free ranging discussion. I am happy to do any kind of Q&A. I might have some cues for you guys to A at some point. We'll go until we are done, and then people will hear this, and that will be the episode.
We're all furiously eyebrowsing over here.
Eyebrows are intensifying.
I don't think I understood a single latter half of what you just said.
Well, it's on the recording, so somebody will someday.
Yeah. Maybe.
For future historians to sort out, yeah.
My first challenge for you, and something I know that a few of us have been curious about based on past conversations, but could you redo that recap from Celian's perspective?
Oh boy, no, I don't know that I could improvise such a thing.
Just put a marker, toss it down.
Well, I tell you what, I'll put a marker. I can't guarantee that anything will be here because
there are dice rolls involved. Like,
well, I didn't really settle any details of what Celian's had been up to during the early stages of this campaign. Mm-hmm. You know, there weren't enough specifics beyond the scope of what you all would be encountering in world.
She wasn't necessary
for me
yet.
To be like, oh, well, while you were in Diamakor, she was hunting down these two gods. Like, you know, mm-hmm. I didn't have to do that, so I didn't.
The novelization from Celian's perspective is forthcoming.
Indeed, yeah. I guess what I can say, I can't necessarily do the recap here, but part of the reason that Celian was not particularly amenable to changing courses is that she had been working towards the position she was in when you all encountered her for at least centuries. You know, it is very much a momentum thing from her perspective. It is very hard as rough equals to kill one god and take their stuff without getting immediately dogpiled by everybody else who knows about it. So she was working very slowly for a very long time, but events were coming to a head beyond her machinations, and she was reaching a critical mass of power at the time when you guys met her. So, try to do some creative writing later. But
you've just admitted that you didn't have every detail planned from the beginning, which is quite a faux pas.
Yeah, yeah. No, I will fall on my sword.
Have you had Adam
as a before? Once,
I was actually thinking about this, though, and like on a personal note, this is definitely the first campaign I've completed. I've had other ones fizzle. I've one-shotted. I was thinking that definitely wasn't true because we'd done one kind of together, but we're still one session, I think, from completing our Over the Edge
Quarantine Times campaign.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
this is my third completed campaign with Adam. And we have historically, you know, in the two prior ones, had these sorts of post hoc, like, let's talk about things and, you know, how we got from point A to point Z over there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and in your case, because we completed two Unknown Armies campaigns that I was GM of, we got partway through a Rain campaign that I was GM of, and then we were both in at least one other completed campaign that we were players in. I wasn't GM for that one.
Yes.
So you have a fair bit of experience with me on either side of the table.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it is how I clung to you like a life raft during law school.
Happy to be of service, if indeed it was a serviceable life raft.
Oh, absolutely.
We've already made reference to...
I talked to you a good deal more than most of the folks from law school.
And we've made reference to using each other as a bit of a life raft during quarantine times, which that sure helped me.
Yeah, that helped me
likewise,
too.
Likewise, yeah. And it got this thing off the ground, which has been immensely enriching to my life, you know, separately from, you know, any sort of audience that experiences these, just having a creative outlet and scheduled socialization with far-flung friends that would otherwise be a little bit difficult to arrange has been tremendously helpful to my mental health, quality of life, fulfillment, and ability to just keep up with you all. So thanks for that.
It's definitely cut into yours and mine, Adam, our extremely sporadic streaming. We've sort of been doing this instead.
Right, right.
But you know what? I'll take it, because this has been really wonderful.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Any sort of other stuff that you and I can do together, Drew, is nice, but certainly kind of a lanyard from my perspective, you know, to this. Though one of these days I will get up to your neck of the woods and bother you in person.
Oh, please do. Please do.
Breathe my molecules all over you and whatnot.
Yeah, yeah, come with the molecules. It's nice here. We got beaches and fishes.
There's so many overtones to that that Joanne would approve of.
The Admiral is going to ship. There's nothing to be done. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I at various points playing Crusader Kings with Adam, Joanne in the background would just have fun on your date, boys.
Well, Joanne is the one who informed me that if you are out and about with one other person and you stop and eat ice cream in an ice cream parlor with that person, that outing is a date now. You know,
I love this. Yeah.
Taking a moment to reconsider large
this also
portions
means
of
I
my
need
life.
To inform several people that apparently I've been
exactly.
on date.
Yeah. Yeah. The same. I was thinking the same.
Exactly.
Quite a longer list than I anticipated.
The best part is that one of those, I was actually mistaken for being on a date with him and his 3-year-old son.
bold.
But circling back slightly to one of my, we can get to particular bits of this, but my general question is, what was the Sirthan's general agenda when they showed up in Vermont?
Yes, let's talk about the Sirthan.
Like their whole deal, yeah. Even as I am re-listening to the published episodes, is so opaque to me.
So one of the big things is that they were hedging their bets, right? They had a few things that they could accomplish, and their strategy was to just kind of do everything to see if they could get anything. So among their goals was to acquire the extant copy of Currents of the Cosmos, which, you know, there was a conversation about, and then it was dropped because they basically assumed that either you didn't have it or you wouldn't tell the truth. So part of the reason they left people skulking around the city is so that they could investigate things like that and attempt to work against Mott while you were out of town. Those are the ones that got in over their heads, as it turns out. But in terms of their, you know, sort of above board goals, they were basically attempting to, shall we say, entice Mott's nobilis into a subordinate role, right? Build a coalition in which Sirtha would be authoritative and Mott would be sort of a client. But they knew they couldn't pitch it that way. So they were kind of expecting more of like state-to-state diplomacy, because they were like, oh, well, Mott has like a city-state and we're like a country. So this is the way we normally interact with neighbors.
And then they met.
And yeah, so they were really, their tools were limited in their usefulness. And their personalities kind of started to get in the way. I have my little booklet here so that I can look things like this up, where I have forgotten things like names. The nobilis of Sirtha who went into the well.
Melis.
Thank you. Melis. Was supposed to be doing more of like a reconnaissance kind of thing, but got really excited when she found the heart of the chancel. And decided that she would attempt, at worst, in her mind, a significant nettle, and at best, a coup de grace. Neither of which exactly worked out the way that she wanted to. Although, you were right to be suspicious, because she was not, in fact, executed. She was essentially very painfully transported back to the country of Cirtha to be, like, given dressed down, but was not actually destroyed.
I think the non-destruction was pretty established even in
indeed, session. Yeah, no, it wasn't a mystery, but what exactly did happen, I figured, could use some elucidation.
Yeah.
Totally.
What was Melis in charge of?
Pearls.
Okay. Because I remember there was a free-floating Nobilis in charge of Ignorance, who was one of the Cirithans.
Mm-hmm. Lenara. Yeah, was in charge of Ignorance. And that is how Ekka was successful at hiding in the city for so long.
Yep. Were there actually servants that went missing?
No, the servants that went missing were the Nobilis in disguise.
Right.
And the attempt to draw attention to it as though it was an emergency was to both create a distraction and to try and get you to owe them something.
Yeah. And we just decided to not.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Again, they were approaching the situation from a different angle than they probably should have if they wished to accomplish what they wanted to.
Yeah.
Yeah, Celian's parallel narrative is limited, as we talked about, but I do love the idea of the Cirithans having this whole parallel story about a bunch of rude fuckers getting almost none of what they want. It's great.
Yeah.
I do love that.
My conception for the Cirithan delegation was, like, I did not expect you all to conduct state-to-state diplomacy with them, right? I expected them to be a problem for you because they were, you know, coming in and expecting one thing while also dealing in bad faith. You know, the idea was for it to be a little bit confusing and chaotic as you figured out what exactly was going on here. And as they realized that, oh, this isn't going to work like we wanted it to.
God, that makes the ending of their story weirdly perfect.
What would have happened if I'd gotten married?
Boy, it's been a minute since I thought about that. certainly they would have attempted to essentially like use that alliance to gain things from the Mott end of the spectrum that they wouldn't necessarily be needing to trade for, and they certainly underestimated how much of a problem it would have been for them, because they would have been essentially trying to make you like the dependent spouse in the relationship as a way of, like, you know, having essentially like an inside man, you know, in Fermata. I had them pull that out primarily as a suggestion because they felt that they were losing control of the situation and needed something concrete, not because they were doing a smart thing.
Oh, for sure. Mm-hmm. Also, like, it was a very good way to add tension to the Das Gromnet ship and get a strong reaction out of Das.
right.
Whereas I absolutely would have been able to cause problems on purpose for them.
Oh, sure. Yeah. One of the things that by that point they were on the cusp of admitting, but still in the process of denying, is that they were not as good at capital H handling the three of you as they wanted or expected to be.
I mean,
I adore that.
That was sort of the first, to me, major instance of us all being chaos goblins toward the same like goal.
Totally. Yeah. I was thinking, yeah, it was an important moment in Dosk and Romnet's relationship, and it was also like, you know, achievement unlocked, become ungovernable. become undiplomaciable, perhaps. At least if you're in bad faith.
Yeah.
Did I cut you off, Robin? Were you adding something to that melange of chaos goblin celebration?
I was just agreeing wholeheartedly with the whole thing. I did have the sense, too. Another thing I wanted to ask about them is that from Ea, at least from her interactions to Lyssa, it seemed like they were under a tighter yoke from Cirtha. And at least kind of sympathized or perhaps even envied the freedom of our characters with Mont comparatively.
Ia in particular felt that way.
Yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. Good. I wasn't off the mark with her then. Okay.
Yeah, she didn't see that she could do much about it, but one of the things that, you know, they were frustrated with how, you know, ungovernable, I guess was the word that you guys used just now. You guys have been like, you know, how divergent from their expectations of how Nobilis deal with, you know, Nobilis of another god. And if Ia had been doing that, she definitely would have been reined in, you know, and like mm-hmm. had been the instrument of punishment for Melis, you know, in going off book. So the idea that Mott didn't have as heavy of a hand, and that you all then used it to be so frustrating, you know, was something that she was both envious of and sort of intensely annoyed by.
This is very affirming. Thank you.
Good, good. I'm glad.
Yeah. If it ever came down to it, I think that Ia would have been kind of the point of contact to try to get more people to join a union.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, I'm very happy with how things
I
played
hated
out.
Ia, so
yeah,
I would not have been helpful.
It would have been a different dynamic for that reason. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah,
for sure.
Very much so. I'm glad it didn't play out that way because the ending of just kind of ignoring them and returning the favors they granted us was magnificent karma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Bye, we're off to kill your boss.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking about it more. Yeah, and it really was like almost a precursor or a different version of or a mini boss to the boss of us having to reject the throne's offer. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like it was like turning aside nobilously, for lack of a better term, you know, noble affairs and like all that kind of stuff and just saying like, nah, fuck that. We have our own thing going on. We're not going to play this game.
We're not here for what you want.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're in our way.
I have a question. You've said before that you didn't expect me to pick the Dusk Ascends path.
Mm-hmm.
How far ahead had you planned? Like, just how many of your plans had to change? As like how might things have been different if Dusk had not become an Imperator?
Well, like with most things, that compounds as we get further from that decision. So it is almost impossible to say far enough out. But it is, in the immediate term, almost as soon as you made that decision, Mott becomes less important and probably doesn't see the end of the campaign. You know, I didn't start thinking specifics about it right away, but I started to be like, okay, well, now, like, Mott is already 50% less important than they were before.
It's silly that I hadn't thought in these terms, but of course, yeah, like, Mott could have been one of the last gods we had to deal with otherwise.
Right, yeah. Well, and because Mott, had they not been hunted by Celiand, could have brought to bear their ability to coerce the other two players, you know, which is part of the reason why I sicked Celiand on them, is because there is dramatic narrative potential and weight in that kind of coercion. But at that point in the campaign, I figure it mostly just feels bad.
Yeah, you know? It would feel an awful lot, emphasis awful, like PvP.
Right. And so I didn't want to take it off the table in case there was a really good, like, narrative or character moment. But after a while, it was clear that, like, okay, if we are going to follow the trajectory that the campaign wants to go on, Mott has to be out of the picture. Because otherwise the question becomes, why isn't Mott acting even halfway rationally, you know, if nothing else out of self-preservation. So yeah, you making the decision for Dosk to ascend numbered Mott's days in a sort of narrative sense, and then as things developed in a pretty literal sense. So that was one big thing. Me having to play Dosk after that point also informed how Dosk's ascension was going to position him, because he couldn't then be on screen that much. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea of having like somebody with Imperator abilities just like being a GM PC in the party was not really going to serve the campaign well. And I did,
which is why it was immediately off the table for, you know, like it was clear from the first, mm-hmm. Ascended Dosk is not a player character.
Right.
Yeah.
And so then the next step there was, okay, well, and then if Dosk is not like on screen all the time, but is fully potent as an Imperator, that changes the tenor of the campaign quite a lot, quite suddenly. So he has to be like on a bad footing. And there are a lot of narrative reasons why he might be. So I didn't want him to be useless or totally absent, but I did need him to be spread thin, you know, and only having like a month, an in-setting month, you know, which is a season more or less, to acclimate to godhood, you know, within the span of the play, meant that he could be very powerful, helpful when he needed to be narratively, but couldn't be relied upon because he was essentially going from never having swum to needing to synchronize swim, you know, very quickly. Sure. And yeah. Kept sinking and having to struggle back up to the surface. Otherwise, Leorian's presence as a nobilis of Dosk opened inter-imperator cooperation up a lot more to the narrative, both in my mind and to you guys, you know, trying to kind of recruit to this coalition, and opened up the avenues for people switching imperators, which wasn't something I had really planned on being possible in setting prior to that point. But again, it needed to be at least a possibility once Dosk ascended. I've reflected on it. This wasn't part of your question, but I've reflected on it a bit since it happened. And part of the reason why I wasn't expecting you to go the Dosk ascends route is because I am accustomed through long experience to players being fundamentally conservative with their characters. And had I been sort of thinking about it from your perspective and not a generic player's perspective more, I probably would have reassessed the odds that you would take that option. But I was basically relying on GM intuition from the games that I've played, and my assumption was, like, no, I think it's less likely that somebody will choose to relinquish their character and roll a new PC mid-campaign. You know, the narrative moment may be tempting, but, you know, players typically don't take that kind of step with a character mm-hmm. they've spent this long with. But then, yeah, when we were talking about it, I realized, like, oh, no, of course this is what this character and this player would do. Silly of me, really.
Well, first of all, I take the compliment, such yeah. as it is, that I'm the kind of player who would do the narratively interesting thing.
And it is a compliment.
And, you know, just in purely practical, and I accept it. I'm working on the whole accepting compliments thing. It's a daily practice.
Yeah.
but, it, like, you know, in purely practical terms, it did add a bunch of work in the middle of the campaign mm-hmm. that I hadn't been expecting, you know, and all of that. But it was, I think, the most narratively interesting thing to do and the most in-character thing to do in that moment, as we talked about at the time. And this kind of, like, goes back to something we talked about in, like, really, really early episodes of Peaks, where, like, you know, because this is the first campaign I've, like, really, truly completed, I was thinking a lot about, like, this is both a game and a story, mm-hmm. you know, and, like, Dosk Ascending is, you know, if it's a video game, that's a quintessential second playthrough kind of thing, right? It's something most people don't pick the first time. But if you're telling a story, it's like, as you say, it opens up so many possibilities, like thematic and character and otherwise.
Yeah. I like the analogy of like a second playthrough kind of thing, because I think that all of us some of the time and some of us a lot of the time are the outliers there who will do the weird thing that's mostly intended to like, well, let me see. Which I guess is another reason for me to bring up that I cannot believe Fire Emblem Three Houses expected me to abandon Edelgard. That is absurd.
Inconfucking-ceivable.
Correct.
That is my student.
And you're going to side with the church against her? Right?
She's
what?
Tearing down in a corrupt institution? Hell yeah, sign me up.
The church, whose like avatar has been super fucking creepy at you the
just
entire
two lesbians
game?
Killing the Dragon Pope. That's the obvious path.
Absolutely. So
I guess you could be playing Boyleth, so that's not necessarily the vibe.
Yeah.
In any case,
Robin, who has not played this game, is making
queers in solidarity killing Dragon Pope.
I'm confused and intrigued.
I think those are the feelings that Fire Emblem Three Houses aims to produce in its...
It's a those feelings machine. Yeah.
It's not worth the time. Just look it up on YouTube. Read the wiki, I suppose. Like, there's a lot there, but at the end of the day, like... There's better queer solidarity games.
The queers have to be subtextual because it is still Nintendo, unfortunately. But
okay.
Well, and
but there is a lot of subtext.
It's almost not fair to not call it text because it's like pushing through the top, like a Cronenberg creature pushing on skin.
It's like the darkness seeping up out of Fermata.
It is very akin to the absence of queer relationships in Persona games, where they wrote it to be like you're about to start dating, and then just the option doesn't come up. It's very much like that. And I would say that the worthwhileness-itude of Three Houses is entirely down to how much you enjoy turn-based tactics in a grid. Because it will take up a lot of your time with that, and if it's something you want to spend your time on, then it's a good use of your time, and if not, then the narrative is interesting, but it's not enough of the experience to self-justify.
If you do like turn-based tactics, Fates might be even better, even though the story is like 95% anime bullshit by volume. The actual like maps are like extremely good. Adam is making a face like I have just
this has become contentious.
Path of Radiance, Blazing Blade, and Awakening are the ones that I think stories and levels. Fates, I didn't even make it through the demo of because mechanically it was terrible, design wise it was terrible, and like
I didn't mean Fates. I'm so sorry. The listener might not know. I'm drunker than I meant to be. I meant Engage. I meant the newest.
Oh,
one.
Okay.
Fates did suck. You're completely correct.
Now we can still be friends.
Okay.
No, that was totally close. Kidding.
Has been mended.
I have not played Engage, although I have laughed at the main character's design. Colgate-chan.
Did you? Colgate-chan.
Yeah,
the story is uncut, weapons grade anime bullshit, but it's extremely good from just like a gameplay perspective. And I can get down with some weapons grade anime bullshit. This is quite a digression we've just
made. Let's get back on the games.
I was trying to get us
pay.
Back on track, and then it just kind
I'm
of
just
kept,
sitting here watching
going.
The world burn.
Many many apologies to anybody who was annoyed
which
by
honestly
the digression.
I think is like a central feature to Romnet.
Kind of. Yeah.
a concurrent theme through the characters I've known you to play.
I mean, some of my characters watch the world burn and are carrying around a thing of kerosene.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Smirking and stroking the kerosene container.
I guess maybe.
Are we all players who are less small C conservative than the average? I wonder if I'm the one who's the most that. Like, I definitely feel that pull to, like, you know, toward optimal play, though I obviously don't always follow that impulse.
Mm-hmm. I definitely don't follow optimal
character sheets. I suspect that I probably
sheets.
Am the most conservative out of the three of us in terms of players.
You think so?
And then again, you know, Sean.
But then you, like, to make these choices that, like, through, you make choices, non-conservative choices at very pivotal moments. So I would disagree that you're the least conservative.
Well, I was going to say that in terms of the character sheet, Des, I think your analysis of yourself is sort of the most sort of traditional power curve growth, you know, kind of what's the word I'm looking for here? It's like gardening or something, but cultivation. You know, that probably is true. But yeah, to Robin's point, I think you do also have a really good instinct for like what's an interestingly chaotic thing to do in a moment that does sometimes carry risks for your characters. Which I do appreciate, right? And
bless you for it, by the way.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, to be chaotic good, one must be chaotic.
Indeed.
have I done this rant on the Peaks at some point that chaotic, lawful good is not actually a thing that exists? Like, the only actual good is either neutral or chaotic good in reality?
I mean, I don't think that you have done that, but one, I would love to hear it. I will sit back and listen. And two, you're not wrong. I say,
as a
lawyer, where law is just, you know, a set of forces and lawyers are force multipliers.
Right. Lawyers who believe that the law is a thing, capital T, capital L, tend to not do much good. Right, exactly. They inevitably become lawful evil or neutral evil. In order to be good, you have to be willing to break shit. Mm-hmm. You can't go in thinking that the law has
systems
any value
are
inherently.
Inherently not good.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's just a bunch of shit
and
people
law,
make like it's it,
in
yeah.
D&D terms is just I support the system. Mm-hmm. I support the status quo. What?
Well, and the status quo is settler colonialists in D&D, so...
Yeah, yeah, and therefore, that, yeah. Like, there's a reason I refer to paladins as lawful awful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, because being in support of the status quo, you know, like, I think a lot of stories in sort of a neoliberal framework, this could be a huge digression, so I'll keep it brief, but, like,
no,
they tend to pose it as, like...
interesting.
Let's take another sip of this 11% here that I didn't realize was that when I started.
Whee.
They tend to pose this really false dichotomy between the violent upheaval of a system and the morally neutral upkeeping of the status quo, ignoring how violent the status quo is every day, all the time.
Ooh, I can talk about Mark Twain.
Do it.
There's a bit of Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court that I really, really love, where... he contrasts the French Revolution's reign of terror with what he calls the greater terror of 1,000 years of feudalism. Basically his thing is like they were both terrible, but the greater terror was more terrible by far than the reign of terror. Because
if Mark Twain could get it, why couldn't Bioshock Infinite? I'm sorry, please continue.
Yeah, no, Mark Twain eventually quite based, if I'm using that word correctly.
He had a journey, it's true.
In any case, I know I threw off what you were saying originally, true, to make my mark.
No, that was like, I couldn't have asked for a better yes.
I played one paladin in all of D&D.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a tiefling in a module that explicitly had like anti-tiefling bias built into the whole thing.
Mm.
And I explicitly got the GM permission to be chaotic good or neutral good, one of those.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically like, nah, fuck gods. I believe in the human capacity for making things better.
Mm.
And ended up getting extra feats because the GM was... marvelous and amused by our leaning into character and so on, with like, you know, being a chef, and basically our quarters ended up being in the like artificer's like shop basically, and I operated a fucking community like soup kitchen. There was always vat of stew going,
so
in the frigid Northlands.
You've played Hardwired Island before then?
I mean, a little bit.
Nobody asked.
Yeah, yeah. We definitely made friends with the sled dog NPC and made the GM like make up a character name for him, and like repeatedly submitting to this like pimply teenage human trying to, like, grift us for, you know, slightly more than the cost of renting the sled dogs and whatever. And so, yes, I suspect that I will have some of the vibe of Hardwired Island going on with my character,
bring,
who will have
bring,
so much
yeah,
bullshit
yeah.
by volume.
To bring that together with our next campaign, with the campaign we just finished, like, I think that's the thing that makes us not especially small or, thank God, large C conservative players, is just, like, part of the reason I want to do stuff like this is just because I have this thing in me that insists that lawful good is impossible because, goddamn it, things could be otherwise.
Yeah, yeah.
And I feel like that's a core theme of what we just
this
giant
Absolutely.
Thing we just did.
Yeah,
and personally speaking, even down to the character construction, it's like very much ingrained into at least my thought process with what I make is stuff that overturns the status quo and what I feel is interesting ways.
Totally.
Yeah. So the last 15 minutes are basically a rambling thesis of our theory of both the world and gaming.
Right. Here's why we made what we made.
I still have questions about the campaign, damn it.
Yes, please. Yeah. I'm sorry. That was, I wanted to get us back there. Yes.
No, that was said with very good humor. Yeah, no need to apologize, Drew. I'm sorry.
No, you're good. You're good.
One of the things, right, from my perspective as I'm laying all this stuff out to get this campaign going and planning it throughout, right, is that I'm very much there's a post, I want to say it was Tumblr or Twitter or something, and I will try to remember to look it up, but I don't know how easy it'll be for me to find. So if you know the credit for it and I don't have it in the show notes, let me know. But the idea is, like, you know, if you have total freedom, to do whatever you want in, you know, parentheses, Mass Effect, Skyrim, Dragon Age, whatever, why do you mostly just go around helping people and doing chores for them? And the person answered, well, because my, you know, power fantasy is being able to, like, make people's lives better and help the people I care about, you know? And so
I've seen this Tumblr post.
Yeah. It's been around for a minute. And when I was putting all this together, right, like, you guys designed Mott to be, like, not especially helpful. And
we did this to us. Let the listener, if we have not made it clear, let us make it clear now. We did this to us.
But we did this to us with the intention, I think, of eventually getting rid of Mott ourselves.
Very much so. Very much so. Absolutely.
Yeah, you built the friction in intentionally, which was great, and I really enjoyed it. But the thing that then I was interested in doing with that from the very beginning is, like, yeah, like, where can you find within running around doing the bidding of this, you know, dark, unknowable entity with no regard for human life, you know, to use the power that you've been granted by that entity to do things that it wouldn't care to do or wouldn't want you to do, you know? And, like, you guys, I knew, you know, because I know you as people and, you know, like you as people would do that without a whole lot of prompting. And so that is where a lot of the sort of early errand running stuff in the campaign came from, is just getting to know the world, getting to know the characters, and letting you just kind of do that, follow your impulse to use your power to, you know, do good in the world. Because even outside of tabletop gaming, like, that's what a lot of people do when they have the ability to, right? Is, like, help each other out, pull each other up, you know? I can be cynical about some things sometimes, but I can never really truly be a cynic, because it has been demonstrated to me enough times in real life and in what people do when they are able to indulge in fantasy that, like, no, they will work for each other, you know, and not just for themselves. And I think you guys did a really good job of just, you know, illustrating that in this fiction that we've all, you know, kind of put together.
Such a beautiful sentiment. I'm not actually choking up. I have bad allergies right now, so I wanted to clarify why my evil voice was just very hoarse.
I didn't have feelings. Don't put in the paper that I had feelings.
But I am a fully apathetic creature.
For what it's worth, I have also had one of the worst allergic reactions of my adult life this weekend, but it is not a respiratory reaction. It is a skin rash, so it does not affecting my voice, thankfully.
I've got the respiratory in down pat, but that happens weekly whenever I have to mow the atrocity that is known as the American lawn.
Yeah. We're looking to kill our local instantiation of that particular atrocity, but yeah, even that's a project.
Yeah. I am intentionally removing myself from any environment where an HOA exists in my future.
Here,
habitat.
Fucking here.
Point of order. I hate to say it. Sometimes HOAs are forces for good in the world.
Sometimes.
Make the case. Because I will admit a reflexive reaction against that statement.
The secret is to take it over with good people.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's weirdly relevant, though, right? Because, like, the question is, do you fucking try to, you know, tear down the master's house with the master's tools, or do you just go fucking wild and not try? You know, like, do you need a complete revolution to make things better? Mm-hmm. Is, like, you know, it's a question that's been on my mind. I can't think why.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I basically was exploring throughout the campaign... connection mm-hmm. you know
you.
Is you know, whether or not all means available system of change makes sense, right? Like, if you can do it through the HOA, do it through the HOA. If you can't, burn it down, you know, like, whatever, right? Incrementally improves something now, here and now, for someone, you know, is, if not the best option, a viable option for consideration is usually my, you know, sort of starting outlook. But it is perhaps a little overly simplistic for some applications, you know, and I, you know, think bears examination, if nothing else. And so thank you three for helping me examine that a little bit for the last couple of years.
Happy to be of assistance.
Yeah, here. It's a good question to work out through a format like this, because it's not a simple question at all, right? Like, it lends itself to metaphor and and collaborative storytelling and working things out.
I think that's what's so compelling to me personally about tabletop, is that it allows us to ask these bigger philosophical questions about society, even the nature of humanity writ large, and the matrices of domination that affect us all, and how those interact with the social and political systems of power. But also it allows us to do some, like, at least soul searching for the inner self as well, and, like, explore things there that are, like, kind of reflective of us as human beings and things that we're personally passionate about or have traveled through in the past.
Yeah, I think that that's something that distinguishes tabletop gaming from... both creating and consuming solo, as it were, narrative content, you know, writing or reading or playing video games or whatever, is that there's this interaction between, you know, the community of people in the game, as well as the community of the characters and the world that the GM has created. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, when I'm writing a story, I am in conversation with myself, whatever source material there may be, if any, and, you know, the sci-fi or fantasy canon such as it kind of warrant. And then, you know, nothing much else.
Well, and one of the things that I really value about it, especially from the perspective of a GM who, you know, gets to play everybody else in the world, is that for players and GMs alike, one of the things that this hobby lets you do is, like, try on alternative selves, you know? And it's not, like, I don't know, immersive, really. It's not like, oh, I lived as this, like, alternate universe version of myself for a week and, you know, found out that I love it or don't love it or whatever. But it lets you sort of, like, create an alter ego that reflects some of your thoughts and feelings, some of your better angels, some of your lower demons, right? Like, lets you kind of pick some things that you're going to portray in ways that you don't usually, but that are in you, you know, already, and take him for a spin. And one of the things, you know, especially as a GM, but also as a player, that's really kind of interesting about that is when it doesn't work. When you're like, oh, I want to do this kind of person, and then you just, like, either can't or don't like it, you know? Which is where a lot of, like, even very detailed, well-thought-out characters often take half a dozen sessions to settle into who they're gonna be as you figure out what the fit is and break them in like a pair of shoes, you know? A massage the structure of that character until there's a part of you that you feel comfortable doing a whole campaign in. I was, because we're doing some meat punks in the near future between campaigns, was listening back to that episode and reflecting on the distance between Radagonda as I envisioned her and Radagonda as I played her. Kind of having this thought. And no guarantees about how consistent her characterization from the first Meat Punks episode, the second Meat Punks episode will end up being. We'll see.
Once you got a slime clone, you have a reason to maybe change your perspective on yourself.
Good point. It's fine. I wish I had a slime clone.
Oh gosh, I forgot about the slime clone.
How could you forget about the slime clone?
I just was hung up on the fact that Viz never found their color.
Yeah, that's true.
There's still time.
Rataslima, if you will.
Rataslima.
Slimaganda.
Slimaganda sounds like something you'd find in a medical handbook, and I will leave it at that.
I think I like mine better.
Have you been screened for Slimaganda recently?
So, okay, I think we had other questions about the campaign.
Yes, mine are very specific.
Awesome, perfect.
And it was not the one I just asked.
Sure, yeah.
So these are very specific to Lissa, mm-hmm. but my first burning question is, who did Lissa reach when she was praying to the dead gods?
I'm trying to remember exactly how I sort of presented this, but the question I was trying to answer is, who did Lissa reach when she was praying to the dead god? And my sort of own interpretation of that, and I'll leave it to our players and listeners how well this lines up with what I actually did, because I don't have the clearest memory of exactly what I did with it, but is basically, okay, I'm going to make a stupid analogy, kind of like scrolling through posts by someone who's no longer with us. You know, you were basically getting what thoughts, feelings, information were left over from them, right? These are beings that were part of the fabric of creation, right? One of the things about Imperators is they are not in charge of darkness, fury, nothing, murder, secrets. They are those things. You know, and so my interpretation of this was, I guess, kind of homeopathy. Like, you know, those things bear the imprint of every Imperator they've been before. You know, and so anytime you were trying to reach out to something that wasn't around anymore, you still were able to get kind of a shape of them.
An echo?
Yeah.
It was like I was talking to a ghost? A holy ghost?
Depending.
Were you trying to steer the conversation to that conclusion, Robin?
No, but as soon as he started describing the answer, I was like, I have to make the pun.
That's fair. Well, it was a direct hit on me, but I was going to say...
I believe a microphone was knocked over in the process as well.
that was mine, but that's because I am shifting around, as I am terminally prone to doing.
I would say that insofar as I imagine ghosts as being things that still have like self-awareness and agency, not so much, but there are traditions of haunting that don't include that. So, you know.
So like the echo kind of deal of it. They're still able to kind of react to stimuli, but they're not actually conscious.
I have it. It's a stupid one that tells a lot about my specific nerddom. it was like interacting with the Hollows that used to be these gods. If you've ever played Dark Souls, the Hollows are things that have lingered for so long that they no longer have will or identity, but they keep on enacting the thing that they were doing in life, right? So the guards are still guards because that's just where they were standing when they lost themselves, you know, over a long enough time frame. You know, the gardeners are still gardening because they were gardening through multiple deaths because they, you know, were doing that and then they lost themselves and they just kept going on autopilot. You know, that's sort of like there is a shape of a thing there, but nothing behind it. And so you were able to glean information from the shape.
Yeah. Last very specific question.
Sure, sure, yeah. I welcome
them. Who were the gates?
Oh.
It was a familiar voice.
Uh-huh. The voice was familiar because it was one of the many voices that Mott spoke in simultaneously.
Okay. Yeah. So, excellent. Mm-hmm. I was barking up the right tree, just not singular enough.
Yeah, and there was, like, not a whole lot you could have done with that information, really. It was just, like, nice little, like, oh, yeah, this is kind of how it's falling out.
I like that.
Well, I liked the idea, too, but didn't end up pursuing it. Sorry, guys, didn't talk over you.
No worries. What, ultimately, was the deal with the Timothys?
Oh, so the Acolytes were... my brain is thinking very referentially because I made this connection after I invented them, but there is somewhere on the internet a post that posits that because there is an Oscar the Grouch in any given garbage can on Sesame Street, that there is actually only one Oscar the Grouch below ground, and that the Oscar the Grouches we see are the extremities of this one entity. You know, that
it's a rhizomic grouch.
Grow into each of the trash cans.
The Timothys are mushrooms! Wait, that technically positive. If we go down the rhizome path, that means that all the Timothys we interacted with were their reproductive organs.
So that wasn't my intention, but, you know, make of it what you
want,
I guess.
But it's apparently canon now, folks.
Welcome.
I was going to say, I'm very sorry, Den.
this beautiful thing you got invested
honestly,
in.
Honestly, of the two personally known patrons, I'm sorry, Derek is the more appropriate.
I said Den because Den wrote the story where an acolyte learns to kiss.
Oh, yeah, no, that's fair.
However, that kind of lines up with our theory.
Yeah.
So anyway, the acolytes were kind of the, I guess you could call them like human interface that less Mott and more Fermata had. Like, you know, Mott kind of wound it up and let it go so that like Mott wouldn't have to interact with the citizens of Fermata. The acolytes could do it. And
did the eggs come from the Reptimothys?
No, they did not come from the acolytes.
Where did the eggs come from?
the eggs came from Fermata. When Mott sealed off Fermata from the rest of the world, they had an idea that there are certain things that cities should have, and one of those things is food. So food could simply be procured. And for most citizens of Fermata, this just meant going to the right market stall, they'd always have stock, or going into the larder, there'd always be something there.
So not only did the egg come first, the chicken came not at all. Robin, did I beat you to the punch?
You did! Well played.
It was really well phrased.
Great minds.
Well, and I was going to say that one of the advantages you had with the acolytes is that the acolytes are some of the only entities in Fermata that could choose what kind of food they found. But, yeah, so they were... I was operating, actually, under the sort of idea that the acolytes were essentially co-opted residents. You know, that they had sort of been... That residents of Fermata had served as the basis or template or food or fuel or however you want to think of it for the creation of the acolytes, and that's why there were confused people in the confluence or the manifestation you know, after Fermata got undone. is that all of the acolyte cruft got stripped away, and the substance that was used to create them was left, and these people were very confused about what happened to them.
Bless them. One of the sad things upon re-listening to some of the episodes is that we never followed up with those confused people. They were just doing their thing. Mm-hmm. And bore.
Well, so if we want a little bit of epilogue, my, what's the word? It's not exactly an assumption if you have control over what happens, but my...
headcanon turned actual canon.
Sure.
Your word of God?
Yes.
There you go, yeah.
My idea for what happened to them is that they got whisked to Boar, and then not that long after that, Boar got reintegrated into the mortal world. And so they were not the only people confused about this, and they were able to relatively readily create sort of new lives for themselves, even though a lot of what they had had before they got enchanceled probably was lost to them forever.
Hmm.
Which I guess was a mean thing to do to a bunch of anonymous NPCs, but you know, I take solace in the fact that they're not real.
Also, they're alive. So, they could still pick up and start anew.
Mm-hmm. It could have gone much worse for them.
It could have gone so much worse.
It went a lot worse for a lot of people in this campaign.
It did. It really did. It did that.
Yeah, while we're on it, do any of our players have any other kind of post-campaign clarification questions? What else would you like to know?
You mentioned the confluence, albeit by misspeaking. Mm-hmm. I'm not on the record saying that was not actually a Final Fantasy XIV reference. I wasn't that far in FF14 when I came up with that concept of the confluence. Dez might have thought that that's where I was going since he pulled me into that world. But yeah, maybe a little bit. I mean, like you talked about how like bringing Vruta back into the picture was like a really cool way to tie up a bunch of loose ends. I very much agree. Was that definitely something that was just kind of off to the side? Because you tried to pull us back to the confluence a few times, and Dosk kind of unilaterally noped out.
Sure,
a few times. Yeah. Like, had you figured out what was going on there at various points of the campaign?
So for a lot of the front half to two thirds of the campaign, roughly, nothing really. Part of the reason why you were being, exposed to the confluence is because you had created it for Dosk's backstory, and because geographically it was the furthest in the direction you wanted to go that you could go a couple of times.
Sure.
You
gamely plopped it onto the map. Mm-hmm. The listener may not know this, right? You had come up with a world map, and then I came up with this thing that would have to exist in the Salt Shoals, mm-hmm. and you were like, oh, cool, you decided it should be in the Salt Shoals, in fact. That made sense.
And it was cool to have there, and I guess what I had in mind for it early on was for collisions between Dosk's mortal life and his life as a demigod. And that's what Dosk was noping out of as we continued to characterize Dosk and, decide on and expose his proclivities. One of them was avoidance. And so he on dipping out, which didn't pose a huge problem. But I decided after Dosk's ascension that it needed something to do since it was there. And so it could be sort of Vruta's launch pad and stage, and it could, give some connection to that early detail of the book that Dosk was looking for, and that I then had the Syrians kind of asking about, of course.
The currents of the cosmos always at the confluence?
I didn't much have a specific place for it for a lot of the early stages of the campaign. It certainly wasn't in Selvan, as Dosk found out. But it could have been kind of anywhere where it was particularly convenient, meaningful, or dramatic for it to show up for a lot of the campaign. But once the Sirthans bringing it up didn't spark any sort of interest in it, I decided that Vruta would come across it at some point because he was the one in the confluence, and the confluence was the sort of place where that book would be.
Because we never established what Dusk was looking for initially. This was a beautiful retcon to tie things together. The Currents of the Cosmos was.
I believe also, that we had come up with the book, if not what it was about or why you were looking for it. We just had like the title as something.
You're
we were
right.
For.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so then I decided to make use of that little prompt. Also,
you're totally right. Yeah. Huh. That's rad. That's rad that we had that early.
Yeah. I mean, and you had it, really, and then gave it to me. Thank you for the gift.
We work well together. We all do.
What was Celiand doing with Veruta?
So, because he was not ennobled, she was essentially attempting to, as I believe you guys sort of concluded, claim him as her prophet so that he couldn't be an ally to you. And the way to get around that was to have him two steps away from Dost and give him an Octoritas to protect him.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, she was essentially trying to use him as either a way to close off a possibility or maybe even an avenue for sabotage.
So I did call that correctly.
Indeed. Yeah, she was essentially grabbing at the opportunity to mess with you guys, and especially with Dusk.
Can you talk about that cult we never met?
Oh, the one from Romnet's backstory?
Yeah.
We kind of met them in that you met Brother Umber.
Brother Umber, yeah.
So he was attempting to essentially resurrect slash expand the sort of heretic branch of the cult. But very early on, we were deciding that the reason why Romnet had the role he did in Fermata is because he had been sort of inducted into a cult that had as its purpose, and correct me if I get any of the details a little wrong, Des, because I am recalling this from memory from a while back now, but the cult's purpose was essentially to keep Mott, like, placated and keep Mott's attention off of mortals.
Mm-hmm.
And Brother Umber's sort of heretic sect was all about the power that could be gleaned if the Obsidian God's attention was drawn to the mortal world. And so they wanted to do exactly the opposite, right? To gain Mott's attention and Mott's favor and Mott's power. And the Orthodox, you know, sort of sect of cult that Robnet was, you know, sort of involved with, their attitude was, oh, you can get the Obsidian God's attention, but you won't enjoy it, and neither will anyone else, which is why we do. And that is actually what the practices in Calavin were sort of, like, descended from, is this idea of, like, propitiating the Obsidian God so that it ignores you. And, of course, the Obsidian God turned out to be Mott. That's why the very early on, and a couple of times later in the campaign, we had the symbol of the closed eye, right? That was the symbol.
Yeah,
of
the war of symbols was the closed eyes, which were what, you know, ended up on the backs of my hands, mm-hmm. versus the open eyes of Brother Umber.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so... was the Obsidian God's gaze averted, or was it fixed on you? It was sort of the theological conflict. Should it be averted, or should it be fixed on you, I guess, might be better articulation of it. Those didn't end up being a whole lot of, you know, neither ended up being extremely involved in the campaign, because we ended up just not doing that much stuff directly with, like, the greater
Mott ended
populace.
Up being... sidelined, the populace ended up being largely irrelevant, and I grew away from mortal things.
But Brother Umber, I had created fairly early on to be sort of the main focal point of the heretic sect of the Cult of the Obsidian God, and so put him in Calavin early on, because that was a center of practice for the Orthodox sect, and then it made sense to me when Mott was sort of, like, shattered for the guy who spent all his time trying to get the Obsidian God's attention to be one of the focal points where that sort of orphaned power could be maybe gravitating toward. Yeah, so he was maybe not the most thematically central antagonist, but he was sort of woven in from the very beginning, and it felt weird not to have him, like, in it somehow. And I liked the opportunity for, if not Mott, then Mott's stuff to sort of try and be directly in opposition to you guys for a while, given that you abandoned Mott.
That was a very satisfying conclusion.
Well, yeah. No, that you tied a whole bunch of the later game things together and back to where we'd started from with fairly extreme amounts of narrative elegance.
Mm-hmm.
Like, quite impressed.
Yes.
Very kind. I had help from three really good players, so much appreciated.
I'd love to meet them sometime.
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
I'd also like, in all of this too, to give just like a pretty belated on-air shout out to Joanne. You may remember from episode zero and from the spooky streets, the post-roll credits and stuff. But she did all.
Yes, we may remember her from those.
We love Joanne.
Yeah,
we love
Joanne. We stand Joanne.
We do.
She did our cover art, our character art as well, and she has done an increasing amount of the editing as time has gone on as well for these episodes. And one of the functions that she has frequently served is as a sounding board for ideas, possibilities, approaches. When I have a couple of ideas and I can't decide on one or the other, I'll, sort of present them to her and see what she thinks. Because again, as an editor, she hears a lot of this stuff, that's been recorded, or just kind of get her opinion on like what's cooler or more meaningful or clearer or whatever. And so a lot of the, a lot of whatever elegance is there, I think I can attribute to, her extremely clutch help and perspective in figuring out what makes sense and what will be fun to play and to listen to. So shout out and thanks to Joanne, belatedly, certainly.
To whatever degree she is the unsung hero of this podcast, let her be sung.
I shall not do the singing because then our listeners would all turn it off, but let her be sung.
She also made speaking of singing, she made an extremely rad album cover for a record I made during lockdown, which was The Other Way I Stayed Sane. She's ludicrously talented.
She is.
See, I certainly think so, but then again, I would.
You can be biased and correct.
It certainly means a lot to me, and I'm sure to her as well to hear it from you all. I guess while I'm doing the thing on the air, if you think fabric arts are cool, or you like frogs, or you just think Joanne is neat, check out anything Sews on places like Instagram and Etsy, because that's where you can see her stuff, as well as our cover art and character.
Speaking as a motherfucker who really likes frogs, I think her work is amazing.
It's true. It's very good.
Yeah, I've commissioned her multiple times.
I've done a commission, and I'm probably coming up soon on another one, and mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out how to get the commission for our second campaign character art.
Certainly once we nail that stuff down, I will be beseeching her to help us out soon. And I think that she will be happy to do so. Because they're adorable, and I am
they truly are
struggling through the process. I was trying to put together like a group shot of us with our characters to be the cover art on our Dice Punks co-host page. I am not very good with graphic manipulation programs, so it is an ongoing project. But
if you need help, let me know.
Thank you. I very, very well might. But that worthy digression aside, what other cues can I add?
You've already ate all my cues.
My cues are feeling pretty ate.
Should have waited until you were drinking. Mm-hmm.
There, Dez is visibly not saying a whole lot of things right now.
Yeah. They are barely contained.
I have some amount of restraint. Well, but only so much.
And we appreciate every ounce of it and every ounce of it that you don't have as well. So I guess my then question, I don't have a whole lot of specific, like, what were you thinking here or whatever, because mostly we've talked about those kinds of things in Peaks already. They didn't need to be concealed past the point. So listeners, if you haven't yet, check out the Dice Peaks. But the thing that I have for you guys is, like, we usually in the Dice Peaks do, like, highs and lows for the session. So I was kind of wondering, like, is there anything, are there any things for you guys that stand out as particularly, like, ace or that you're proud of? I'd love to hear what you're proud of, in the campaign, actually. And then, you know, maybe less happily, but certainly easier for me to come up with, is there anything that you, given a do-over, know how you would do it over better? You know, that you were just like, oh, I had this other thing that I, it would have been better or more interesting to do or whatever. Just, you know, reflections, I guess, is the short way of putting it.
I think the thing that I'm probably proudest of is my reconciliation with Dosk.
Mm-hmm.
That's a worthy one. Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. It's great.
Well, and as
like, it was not necessarily like the aw hell yeah-est of moments. That honestly is probably just a variety of my later game mass or large scale murders, depending on whether we're looking at one or multiple bodies dropping.
There were some hell yeah murders in this campaign.
There really were.
There really were.
But the sort of 2.5 party character work of Romnet reconciling with Dosk was very good and very satisfying.
Yeah, and as the person who had to pilot Dosk through it, I felt like I felt like you had, like, pre-accomplished a lot of the work, right? Like, sort of set tone and parameter such that all I really had to do was, like, follow the cues, and it turned out really well, you know?
It really did, yeah.
So, yeah, a very, very worthy submission for a proud moment. I think it was pretty well pitch perfect.
One thing Dez and I talked about offline really early on was that, like, the relationship, drama is even the wrong word, because, like, what we were talking about was, like, these are characters who work shit out like adults. And, like, what we didn't say out loud at the time, but I think Dez, you know, don't let me put words in your mouth, but I think we're on the same page here, is that, like, that's underrepresented in media, just people sort of, like, working things out in sort of a rational, mature way.
It's so much harder to write. I say this having written both sides of it.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
It is so much harder to write engagingly from a tension and drama standpoint because, you know, happy ending, people think that's boring. It's not, but people think it's boring. Two, like, there's less drama to a reconciliation, and three, a lot of people haven't seen it in their real life to know how to write it.
Yeah, totally. Which is, it's like a recursive loop, right?
Yeah.
Because, like, you're modeling your own sense of romance on a world in which that doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. So it's like round and round it goes. So I think there's a huge amount of value to modeling that in fiction.
Exactly.
And seeing, yeah, yeah.
just as a very, very brief aside, I do not want to derail us. This is actually one of the things I ended up really appreciating about the Owl House, because the characters are young and feeling their way through, but they actually do it. They do feel their way through, and then it's actually very satisfying to see that. And it's a rare instance in fiction of people, like, giving each other the benefit of the doubt, communicating, etc. So kudos to us, I guess, for putting a somewhat lower profile one on the pile, but putting it on there nevertheless.
I gotta watch Owl House. I've heard good things.
Do it.
I will. Oh, God damn it.
It's also on my list of things, but I am very bad at watching things. So.
Well, and it's done now, so you don't have to wait on
it. As a citizen of Tumblr, I am extremely aware.
Citizen of Tumblr. That's your primary citizenship, I think.
No, I have dual citizenship with Ireland as well.
Fair.
Pretty solid recommendation for that. And, you know, one of the only other entries in the tradition of, you know, people handling relationships constructively, which, yeah, was one, something that I enjoyed about the dynamic there, because, like, you know, it isn't like Romnet or especially Dask, as Drew decided to play him, were like perfectly serene, unflappable, you know, like omni-empathetic you know, individuals.
We were both such disasters, it was great.
Right, but yeah, well-meaning adults, and that was, I think, really cool.
Mm-hmm. Disasters, but not the archetype of, you know, disaster bisexuals or whatever.
Right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, I miss that ship.
Plenty of kudos. kudos on that as well. Perhaps less. Perhaps there's less to talk about with it, but I also, while we're on ships, really enjoyed doing Mavia and Rhymalus. Was just very fun. It was just very fun, and that's all I really have to say about it.
That was a very fine ship.
It was an extremely good ship.
Yeah,
it was. I'm still shipwreck it to this day, which is why Rhymalus got a shout out in the prologue.
Yeah. Hell yeah! Content. Hell yeah!
I do shipwreck it, furious one.
So fun to do.
Yes.
Absolutely.
I had an actual dream in which I was like trying to come up with a Mavia and Rhymalus tattoo.
Oh my gosh. If you ever come up with it, let me know. I will not commit fully to getting it. However, I would very strongly consider it.
Would be submitted for consideration for sure.
I'm still deciding where to put a snake on me at some point.
Ooh, that'd be cool as hell.
That'd be amazing.
For the record, for our listeners, just in the last like 2 weeks, I got my first ever tattoo, you know, almost four decades in, and I am thrilled with it. But it is not a Nightfall related tattoo, unfortunately, but still.
It's related to another amazing sustained
tattoo. We should all get Nightfall tattoos.
Ooh, I don't hate that idea.
Like, they could be anything of our choosing, so, like, even if it's only tangentially related to the content.
That bears some thinking about. I thought about the tattoo that I just got for 7 years before I got it, so.
Yeah, like.
I also have one tattoo that I thought about for half a decade to a decade. I will get
exactly
more.
What I would get for a tattoo if I were to get a tattoo, but I'm not terribly interested in a tattoo.
And that's fair.
That's fair.
It's totally fair.
I also know what the second one would be. So the Nightfall one would be a, like, third.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I would definitely be more tatted by now if COVID hadn't happened. Mm-hmm. It slowed me down.
I would be covered in tattoos were they not costly.
Yeah.
That's a good when point. Done properly.
Yeah. God damn
you. I'm already up to three.
Nice.
Yeah. But yeah, fun aside, I'm really happy with the tattoos, so I had to tell everybody about it.
It's a good one. It's a good one.
It is a great one.
Anything else we're particularly pleased with or proud of, or anything we feel that we would improve upon given a second chance at life?
Something that's marginally insane that I've never talked about is Leorian has this one quality where he doesn't speak the same way all the time. I really hope this came through on the show. I haven't actually asked anyone. But he speaks more formally. He does kind of the old-timey speech that we mostly avoided in this campaign. You know, my lady, it seems the gods are wont to eat their young, etc. When he's uncomfortable, when he doesn't know what his place is in the conversation. And
that definitely came through.
Okay, I'm really glad. I'm really glad. Because I hope it didn't just come across as like, that's how it sounds when I pre-write it. When I'm improvising, I don't do it. Because I try to be really intentional about when he does that shit and when he doesn't. And to the degree that it came across, I am very proud of that. Because it was like a neat characterization, I think.
That was very cool. Yeah. I personally enjoyed watching the more uncomfortable Leorin got.
Real, yeah.
The increasingly formal he became. Which was like a weird foil to my character. So I thought it worked nicely.
Oh, I'm super glad that came across. Yeah. Because it is, it's weird that we've never talked about it. We actually never have.
And then both of these are a slight contrast to Romnet, who is oblique, 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 oblique. I am done with this shit. We are busting through face first.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Mm-hmm. Totally.
Well, which totally doesn't mirror how I operate in the world.
Well, and then the Lorian's case, especially, like, I know that I picked up on it because I'm watching Drew do it on the camera. And because I know Drew, so I'm curious if our listeners picked up on it as an intentional thing, and if not, maybe it's now a fun little thing you can look out for on re-listens. If you go back, you can hear Leorian getting more and more uncomfortable and more formal.
You could, it's a total Rosetta Stone or a Rorschach test. It's more Rosetta Stone. You can tell how comfortable he is or not by how much he does that shit. Or
a Rorschach Stone, if you will. So.
Rorschach Stone.
That's a Rorschach pop.
Bravo.
Beautiful.
There it is.
Oh, man. You know, I won't get bogged down in it. Or Robin, you had something?
So we were still on kind of campaign highs and things we wish we could improve. I'm unsuccessfully trying to buck my habit of going last.
Sure, yeah.
From some weird southern sensibility of manners. I guess, as a whole, I am most proud of Lissa's character arc. Mm-hmm. And its proximity to my own journey dealing with PTSD. Like, she was always kind of a final exorcism of demons that I've dealt with and their last hollow well. And one of the things that I thought about starting off this campaign is just when I realized that my domain would be fury, all the rage that I felt and the fact that it's sometimes a reasonable reaction to dealing with trauma. So, like, on one hand, I'm proud of that, and I'm also proud of the fact that I never once define in any concrete way what her trauma was.
Totally.
Yeah. I think we're probably, I speak for everybody when I say that, like, watching Lissa over the course of the campaign was a great pleasure.
I strongly agree.
God, she's such a good character. I've said this to you, I think online and off, that I just, the way you map out character arcs and the way you like spring load things that are not known to the other players and maybe not even to the GM initially in order to like explore that stuff is just like, I have so much admiration and respect for the way you do that and how much meaning you pull out of it. It's
because
I'm sorry if this is uncomfortable because I too am bad at taking compliments, but you're fucking good at that.
Really? Yeah. And I'm glad you brought it up as something that you were pleased with, because you well should be. And to me, I want to specify a thing about it that is the whole construction of Lissa's character and her arc was, I think, really good. But one thing that is particularly impressive to me as somebody who does the session planning and sometimes struggles with this sort of thing is that you weren't just really on point with Lissa's construction. The follow through was extremely consistent from the very beginning to the very end in ways that were interesting, often entertaining, and felt like natural and organic progressions, you know, from what had come before. So even being a little bit on the inside and knowing more about your character up front than our other players or our listeners would have, it was still a fun journey of discovery and just kind of like arm pumping moments of like, yeah, you know, that was really fun. And like, I think you get to take a lot of credit for it, you know.
I also don't want to leave it merely implied. Thank you for like trusting us to be a place where you could like work that shit out.
Extremely like, bad.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I think that's a testament to you guys. And some of my progress dealing with PTSD, that I felt able to do that in a setting. Cause I couldn't think of, like, when I was thinking through what fury meant to me, like, that was the first thing that came to mind. Mm-hmm. It was definitely something that, like, hopefully resonated with someone else that maybe didn't understand that's the particular beast they were dealing with and what's behind the shadows and fear and the rage of it all.
Mm-hmm. To specify something that you just kind of touched off, you know, in your phrasing, especially there just now, is that like I didn't have in my head a clear picture at the very beginning of what the end point for like Lyssa and Avia and sort of their dynamic would be. And I feel I didn't have to, you know, but I really like that you ended up where you ended up, where you still had Alyssa and Amavia, but there was like concord, you know, between them that felt very like natural and kind of poetic, but also like for me as the GM, deeply satisfying.
Yeah. That was one of those things I was on the fence about because I know it came from a very particular therapy session. where I was kind of expressing frustration with like this other, like, it wasn't like a, you know, as separate as Media and Lyssa, like, were due to miraculous means, but there was like this definite reversion that I would go through. Like I would revert to some other younger version of myself when dealing with it. And I was told by my therapist after voicing those frustrations that I shouldn't be frustrated because that was like simply who I was in that younger stage that I needed to be to get through it. And that's kind of like where the entire dynamic came from. Like where I decided, well, like I very deliberately never mentioned it was Lyssa as herself underneath all of the Mavia guys. Because I was always kind of entertaining going in that direction. So I'm glad it played off because I was a bit of a risk.
About that, in terms of Romnet's sort of befriending and feeling closer in some ways to Mavia at times than to Lyssa.
Yeah, I love that aspect.
Which was delightful, yeah.
Yeah, it was very cute.
Yeah, I hope that came across with Leorian too, where like, you know, because he met Mavia first, if I recall.
Yeah.
And the idea of like, you know, it was immediately clockable. It's like, okay, this person is further along than I am, more experienced than I am, is perhaps frightening, but knows what's up and, you know, has experiences that are immediately recognizable to me.
Yeah.
You know?
And for that reason, like, the interaction between Romnet kind of defending Mavia when we first met Siliand, and then Ligorian forgiving Mavia are like two of my favorite moments in the campaign, aside from getting to wreck an entire army. But.
That shit was just good.
Fine. Yeah.
The forgiving Mavia scene, I think, is something I'm really proud of too, because that was something we had to do at some point, and I think the way it played out was pretty so perfect good. From my perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because it really had a lot to do with the aspect of Mavia being about PTSD and like, you know, forgive, like someone being responsible for their actions, but also being part of a long chain of events that, you know, that is bigger than them. That's a really fucking hard thing to talk about in reality or to write about in fiction. And I think we did an okay job.
Yeah. I'd say so. This actually brings up something that I think we did a pretty good job of, and I don't know, you know, how much credit I can take for it, but to me, a lot of the climactic moments of this campaign were those sort of like fairly personal, but fairly like not always intense, but like impactful, you know, sort of interpersonal scenes. Yeah. That said, we did also have wrecking an army, ascending to godhood, you know.
yeah.
Wasn't what you would call subtle. Yeah.
You know, murdering a chancellor or two. Like, there were things
some unchancellings. There was that time where I mass murdered the reflections.
Yeah, like, there were mm-hmm. big, sweeping moments that were appropriately climactic. And I'm glad we had both kinds, you know. But I mm-hmm. think it does say something, and I think it's something fairly positive about the, you know, kind of way we approach this and how we handled it, that the big stuff was kind of in that like early final act, and as we got closer and closer to the close, to borrow Dez's phrase, the work we were doing got closer and closer, you know, even as its impact broadened out. And I guess the thing that, you know, sort of expresses that dynamic very perfectly is the throne just being mean and petty on an individual level at the very end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that was such it was an inspired choice, really.
It really was.
We've talked about some of that in the peaks of last time, but like the sort of, it was a denouement that was more of an anticlimax that like sort of pushed it back to, no, really, the moment we knew what we were doing, it was a foregone conclusion. The climactic getting there was really just dealing with the obstacles in the way.
Mm-hmm. That power that has a purpose, that seeks to make the world different or better, is necessary and valid and meaningful. But that power that seeks just more power is petty, right? Like that I think was like maybe one of the thesis statements of the campaign in some ways. And like that was such a cool way to illustrate that.
And I love it too, because like whatever had to be at the head of this for all of the trauma and heartache and violence and chaos that came as a result of this endless cycle had to be petty to keep replaying it over and over again.
Yeah,
totally, totally.
Or so completely stuck on itself that like it is its own cycle of trauma.
Yeah, like that's another theme that runs through it, is that like the most heroic thing you can do is to like break a cycle of abuse.
Yeah, well said. One thing, it's a very small regret that I have that just touched off in my head, because we're talking about like power and its uses, and we've done it for a few peaks, and we've done it for, I mean, a few times in session, and we were talking about it here. In Nobilis, one of the things that you call a Nobilis is a power.
Power.
And yeah, I totally underused that terminology. I really did. And I regret not employing it more frequently.
One of the most memorable phrases in my college gaming, which was my introduction to Nobilis, was a friend who hadn't quite yet become a friend. Like talking as I was approaching about this game where he had been the power of cheese.
Yeah. there's a bit in the Nobilis second edition rulebook where everybody was very dismissive of the power of blankets until they realized that they could never sleep soundly again.
I guess like my like thing that I wish I had done better kind of hinges on this idea of like breaking the abuse of power, and this concept, because like I had built in kind of from the start this imagery of the snake and the snake eating its own tail as representative of what Lyssa was going through. And I regret not making that the final way that she destroys her fury by intentionally making Fury eat itself in the way that it is want to when misapplied. Because I think that would have been like a nice little end cap to...
That would have been beautiful, yeah.
Yeah, like finally kind of coming full circle on the whole Ouroboros symbolism that I was playing around with. I even have a document that has like a list of all the mythology, the fact that on her symbol, like there's color theory and stuff like that. So it would have been a nice way to kind of touch on that.
Well, especially, I guess, since at least my recollection, I'd have to go back and examine the tapes, as it were, to be sure. But my recollection is that you were always pretty reluctant to use destruction miracles on Fury. But, you know, for what it's worth, I definitely see where you are coming from there. And, like, yeah, I agree that it you know, would have been very appropriate. On the other hand, it wasn't something that I consciously missed either, you know? So as things to, you know, have left unrealized go, I think, you know, not a load-bearing regret. But I do get where you're coming from, for sure.
Totally.
I think what I probably would have done a bit more of would be actually trying to work my backstory in a bit more. There were a variety of moments where I would sort of like tease how like secretive Romnet had been about where he came from. When it had been Semarin, I mean Fermata all along.
Right.
It was almost a total question mark, almost until the very end.
There were a few things sort of here and there that I deliberately tried to like flag, but also like I was mortal for the first 40-some percent of the campaign.
Yeah.
I picked up on the flagging though, because I like, even before the big reveal, my headcanon was that, oh, this is the city that had been overridden, more or less. Like,
Well, I guess that brings up one of my sort of, I hesitate to say regret because this is the nature of the beast, but like my conception of Romnet's role in the campaign ended up being almost entirely unworkable out of the gate once the rubber met the road. And so I think the listener can probably hear me straining to make sure that Romnet has germane things to do early on, until I eventually did have to just abandon the original conception of how the dynamic and how the pacing and how the structure of the story was going to work. And, you know, it feels wrong to go and be like, oh, well, I regret not just making Romnet part of the, you know, party to begin with, because like that's just the nature of play. But I guess what I wish I had done is abandoned that initial construction sooner, you know, and not tried to hang on to it once it was clear that it wasn't the way that the campaign was going to go. I think ultimately, Des, you did a really good job of, you know, sort of pivoting and, you know, being integral and, you know, like I think it ultimately worked out fine, but I do kind of regret not being more intentional and flexible earlier on.
I think, you know, some part of my ability to be integral, or at least in necessary like appearance for those sessions where I was there as myself rather than as the peanut gallery, was the relationship with Dask, where initially we just looked at each other and were like, so we're doing this.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, that was... I was very... I enjoyed a lot of the early character work you guys did in I mean, I enjoyed all of the character work that everybody did throughout the campaign, but that early character work between the three of you was particularly delightful, because I don't think anybody exactly knew where it was going, but everybody was like really enthusiastic.
We're excited to see where we do get that.
And that was a fun energy. Yeah. I'll add a silly one. I guess silly isn't the right word. But like, I am proud of us putting out 55 episodes plus this one in this campaign and getting it to the end.
It's not that silly. Like, there's a lot of labor.
That's the antithesis of silly. That is like probably the most significant thing that as a unit we've accomplished.
Seriousness itself embodied in that point.
Yeah.
And you know, like I appreciate everybody who has listened for all or part of that run. I guess I'll get a little bit personal, and I guess, you know, hopefully listeners, this doesn't come off as too indulgent or anything, but like I'm gonna be 40 before too long, and most of the collaborative type things I've tried to do in my life have been things where I have a really cool conversation with people that I'm like vibing with really hard, and we're really excited about it, and then I go home and I take steps toward doing the thing, and when I come back golden retriever style with the slippers in my mouth, you know, when I come back with what I've prepared, the interest isn't there, and in a couple of cases the reaction is, oh wait, you actually did that, you know. And that's extremely unpleasant, but was kind of the thing that I expected most, you know, by the time I got, you know, into my 30s, expected most such things to go that direction. And so it is very rewarding and very meaningful, and I cannot express how much I appreciate our players, our listeners, our patrons, for sticking this through, right? And the three other people on this recording with me in particular, like, you know, have absolutely given me a gift here. And, you know, we are here. It's been, what, a little over 2 years?
Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to figure out exactly when we recorded that first episode and just never got around to it.
I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, the recording was in the fall. We released it in the spring. So, yeah, we're coming up relatively quickly on the third anniversary of the initial recording of episode zero.
Because the swamp episode was when I was sick with plague, I think. Like right around then. Yeah.
Which was like a election time, right?
Yeah, thereabouts. Yeah, because for sure. Yeah, because I got COVID working the 2020 election. Yeah.
So yeah, like it's really like, I guess it just means a lot to me that you guys have stuck it out and intend to continue doing so. you know, and whether or not, you know, this ever reaches all that many people, it means a lot to me to have done it. You know, and like we're gonna keep going. But to have seen it through like one whole campaign already is more than I ever really allowed myself to believe at the outset that we would end up doing. Not out of a lack of faith in the three of you, but just, you know, out of trepidation from past experience. Can't thank you guys enough. Can't thank our listeners enough. Just sticking with it. And now, you know, 3 years in, I'm not worried that it's all gonna, you know, go away next week. I'm excited for what's coming next, especially our interstitial bits with Drew and Meat Punks and Desmond and Armies. I get to be a Blair for a while. It's gonna be a disaster.
Yeah, you do.
But like a fun kind of disaster.
The kind of disaster we are wanting to make as a group.
I have not done huge amounts of GMing generally, particularly without a co-GM who often does 50% plus of the work. We had our weird thing with the second Unknown Armies game where I would GM sessions where Adam was absent, and it was this entirely other thing. The players found themselves in a house, usually a living room.
But we did dovetail it at the end of the campaign in a way that I sure couldn't have done by myself. So, you know.
But I've also never run a one-shot before. So I have no idea how many sessions of this one-shot there will be.
Yeah, and
I feel that.
We'll find out. I'm going to say we shoot for three and see what happens.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I just want to reiterate how proud I am of us for doing 55 episodes, now 56 of this thing.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
We've done very well.
I also, I think it's telling of the emotional investment that I can't, despite forgetting the Forge at the beginning of this episode, which I'm going to be kicking myself for the foreseeable future.
We're fellow travelers, you and I. Have I mentioned that? Yeah.
Yeah. I want to also mention that I essentially went through, like, the five stages of grief processing that the campaign was done, like, which I think shows how central it was, at least in my life.
It's been really important to me, like, I have limited in-person social because for the history of ever, you know, much of my social life has been prosecuted digitally, is the phrase that I usually use as the set piece there. And that was, you know, significantly more so than usual when everyone else was also doing it during the plague years, which, you know, haven't stopped except that we've been told they have. So on we go. And so having this sort of stable touchstone of, I'll get to play games with nerds. Specific ones.
I try to be a specific.
I'm going to make up a business card that says specific nerd.
Specific nerd. Yeah. That's a goal of mine, too, because I get called that a lot as a compliment in my workplace. But yeah, like trying to figure out what to do now that I no longer have to plot the next graphic murder of the enemy or actively pick out songs that remind me of Lesson of Patia and Rymalus and Kea, it's been a weird thing to navigate, so I've been throwing myself whole hog into what comes next, which is the next character.
Well, I don't want to welch, because you all brought up, like, a thing you thought you could do better, and I've thought several times that I could have been more crisp with, like, the way Leorian changed, right? Because he started out, like, being super excited to be a nobilis, to be a demigod.
Yeah.
And gradually, like, I think I had in my head initially that he would, like, become jaundiced about that and realize, you know, fuck all of this. But what ended up happening was, like, a lot more subtle. It was more an arc about how faith is not a thing most people ever really let go of. They just incorporate the ability to, like, welcome people in and make the world better into what they already believe. And that was, like, not a decision. It was totally organic. And it's a theme I want to try to carry forward into more stuff we do. So yeah, I don't know. It's hard to say I wish I'd done it better because I learned something from the way it played out.
I loved Leorian's arc because I felt like every kind of shift and turn that he took affirmed him as like an extension of Dosk in a way. Like it was very apparent from the get-go exactly why Dosk had chosen this person. And it personally would have crushed me if Leorian ever became jaundiced to borrow your term, because I think that kind of optimism was very crucial when the options were, hey, we might wreck the world, or we could make it significantly better.
Totally.
Because, like, personally speaking, the wrecking the world was never a belief or option. Like, keeping that faith that a better world was possible was crucial to why, like, Lyssa went free with everything, and I think Leorian and Romnut really helped perpetuate that.
Totally. No, I learned a lot from it, because you're totally right. Like, I kept waiting for the part, like, okay, here's where Leorian could become less optimistic, and it just never felt right for him to. And, like, I think I learned something as a person from that, you know?
Yeah, well, and I appreciate, Robin, you using the exact phrasing you did, because, like, we called ourselves Dice Punks, and it's, you know, partially because it's got a really cool ring to it, and I've always felt very much, you know, the poser in punk situations, because I'm too reserved to, you know, present sartorially or my attitude as, you know, like, that attention grabbing. But, like, when I've seen Anti-Flag, when I've seen Strike Anywhere, right, like, one of the things they say toward the end of their shows is, you know, a better world is possible. You know, that's one of the rallying cries, you know, of the whole scene. So I leave it to the listener to decide whether or not we have earned the punk part of our self-selected designations. But I couldn't be happier that we, you know, for our own purposes, at least, you know, prosecuted the kind of commitment there. Because one of the powerful things about tabletop role-playing, as with most kinds of fiction, to be fair, is that you can imagine the world other than it is. And I think it, you know, is perhaps underutilized function of imagination, you know, as it relates to media, to imagine a better world and how a world could become better. I don't know, that resonates with me deeply. Maybe, you know, is me, you know, in my wide-eyed idealist mode, but I don't know, that seems like a better way to live.
It does.
Yeah.
I often categorize myself jokingly, because Alyssa had golden retriever energy, which is something that's come up a few times. I am the black hat girlfriend, now fiance. So, like, being able to play and exist in a space where there is that kind of eternal optimism has been very good for me.
Mm-hmm. Mazel, by the way.
Yeah.
I think I did say it on air last time, but still, can't be said enough. But no, totally. Yeah, no, like, believing not just that a better world is hypothetically possible, but that you can take active steps.
Yeah.
That shit gets you up in the morning.
Yeah, actually, mm-hmm. In fact, to tag onto that, the last time that I saw Anti-Flag, it was not just a better world is possible. They say, we believe that a better world is not just possible, but it's right around the corner.
There it fucking is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I gotta go to another show, you guys.
Okay, as long as we're talking about shows, yeah. I saw Deerhoof not too long ago. They have a record out called Miracle Level, and their whole idea is we can phase out all non-miracles within the next, you know, couple of decades. The only remaining non-miracles are things like oil. You know, like it's small stuff, right? We can be a miracle-based reality if we just commit to the idea. That it's so abstract and strange, but it pumped me the fuck up, so I thought I would share
it. The way that while I wasn't paying attention, Deerhoof became part of the Meat Punks universe.
It happened so subtly that we hardly noticed. Yeah.
That's great. I love that. Gosh. Well, I guess this is less immediate, but I'm from South Louisiana. Bad Operation is a New Orleans based Newtone ska band, and they just put out some new music, and one of their debut albums tracks leads off with Eat the Rich, Feed the Kids. So
there it is.
Listen to some Bad Operation, you guys. It's gonna be my
Bad Operation's so good.
It feels kind of like maybe we're winding down here, but I want to give everybody the opportunity for kind of whatever your last thoughts for this particular retrospective are going to be. I mean, it's not like last thoughts, because
everyone else has talked about their character arcs. I don't actually, like, what would you guys identify as Romnet's character arc?
He's not a flat character. I feel like that's important.
I really enjoyed the fact that you've often mentioned, and this came across too, that, like, Romnet very much absorbed the goodness of the other characters. Like, he in and of himself, like, on his own devices.
He could have been a legit war criminal.
But because of the company and because of the kind of relationships he forged, that seemed to be, like, there were other connections he had from his past life, but they were new to his current life, both in Vermana and as a Nobilis. That kind of allowed him to become a crucial player, where murder was less of a moral crime and more of an execution. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was, like, just really cool to see. And I enjoyed, like, the dynamic where, like, obviously he and Lissa, they got along, but there was, like, a bit of a dissonance there. But him realizing that, there's depth beyond this kind of goofy, always smiling kind of veneer that Lissa presented herself as was the linchpin of their relationship. So that's a bunch of word vomit for the character arc that I perceive as Romnet, but I think that's one of my favorite things about your characters, is that they have the potential for the maniacal, but often veer in a more positive altruistic direction.
Usually, Adam can attest to this. I frequently build characters with an inbuilt NPC to act as sort of a self-foil. So I guess I do sort of build characters to be foils to something. Mm-hmm. Or to have foils built in. But this is one of the first major games that I have had where I haven't had an NPC foil. So I think I basically was like, ah, this time it will be the other players.
Yeah. Well, and like,
without consciously announcing that to myself.
Yeah. Well, like, Romnet had the potential to be, I don't know, disinterested or uninvested, but didn't go that direction, because obviously not, you know. But one of the things that I think was really fun about Romnet's journey is he never stopped being sort of uncompromising and at times blunt, but started using those tools in more and more particular ways, you know, as the campaign went on. I think about Creasis in particular here.
Yeah.
But also, like, you know, I was talking earlier about how, you know, Lyssa and Mavia were usually reluctant to use destruction of Fury Miracles, contrasted with the number of destructions of murder that Romnet did, outnumbering the creation.
Yeah, at the end there, I just announced, by the way, I'm swatting all murders.
Right, and so some of the murders that you created were very significant and weighty, but kind of by volume, you did a lot more destruction of your domain than most people.
As a non-joiner who believes in stuff, I found Romnet extremely relatable, and I dare say important to me. Because there was an arc there, but it was like, it was not giving a shit in a constructive way, as opposed to not giving a shit in a sort of self-negating way. And that's like maybe a subtle shift from the outside, but it's like, it's everything. That shift is everything.
This was a really fun ride, you guys.
This was great.
Excellent people to do this kind of thing with, and I can't wait to see what else we end up doing with it. I look forward to being a player under both Drew and Dez, and maybe one day Robin. We'll see.
Yeah,
no pressure.
Old Gods of Appalachia.
Oh, yeah.
I'm still waiting on that PDF. Though it's obviously behind, because initially I think the delivery date was supposed to be March, but it's become a bigger project than they realized. Sure, yeah. So, yeah, well, I'm looking forward to sharing that.
God. Yeah, I mean, I cannot wait to play that with you GMing. That's going to be
exciting.
Amazing.
That sounds
incredible.
For sure.
That's some pressure. I'm going to just
no
pressure.
Not pressure, anticipation.
No pressure, only joy.
Yeah.
Okay.
For real. So yeah, I guess, what do you guys want to end on here before we wrap up?
On to the next.
Exactly. I feel like we've like established what's possible here. I think we learned a lot. I think the thing itself was cool as fuck. And I love you all a whole lot.
Yeah.
I love you guys. And our listeners. There's just a lot of love here.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
They're not necessarily in the heart of my next.
I guess we'll find out.
I'm curious about that now.
For real, yeah. I look forward to seeing Viz again. I look forward to seeing everybody's Unknown Armies characters, and I look forward to seeing what we do in Hardwired Island I'm going to guess between 20 and 30 episodes, but we'll see. I've been wrong before, frequently.
And I will say, Viz, Rat, and Billiam are going to meet some genuinely awful people as Meat Punks continues, but they might just kill them, so that's fine.
That is much more likely.
Launch Elon Musk into the sun.
Yes.
Well, if the listener does not recall, the in-world equivalent of Elon Musk has been heavily foreshadowed.
Yeah, for real, yeah.
Yes.
I don't remember the in-world name, so I just think of that person as Elongated Muskrat.
His name is Elias Oakley Muskrat. Okay.
Gotcha. All right. Well, thank you guys for taking some time to process and digest all of this with me. I hope our listeners have enjoyed hearing this part. So everybody can get one life experience. You can't spend it on anything, but you can have it.
Oh, man. I was going to immediately spend it on time management.
Yeah, fucking right. Yeah.
All of us, all the way around. But That concludes this Nightfall retrospective episode of Dice Punks, and that concludes Nightfall. Thank you for sticking with us, and thanks for joining us this whole way. I hope our players and listeners enjoyed this retrospective and our campaign as much as I did. I hope that you'll all join us again for our upcoming interstitial games and for our next campaign in Hardwired Island. If you're hearing this now, you probably know where to listen to us, but you can be found almost any place one can listen to podcasts, as well as on the wider web at dicepunks.com, and probably still on Twitter as at dicepunks, but you can also find us as dicepunks on co-host, and one of these days soon I'm going to be setting up a Tumblr, so check around. With that, I think we're ready to say farewell, so say goodbye to the kind folks at home, players.
Thanks for listening. A better world is possible. I would like to think it's right around the corner. Let's fucking get there together.
Oh, yeah.
Damn it.
Shit. I did the thing again.
You
could
just
I'm
say
sorry.
The same thing. It's fine.
Thanks for listening, everyone. A better world is possible. I need to think it's right around the corner.
Hell yeah. Thanks for listening, folks. A better world is possible. And we should make sure that we get there.
Fucking yes.
Hell yes. So I realized.
Yeah, but in order to get around the corner, we kind of have to round it together, you know?
Yeah, there it is.
I realize that there is now some pressure for me to say, as the poet once said, a better world is possible, and it's right around the corner. But I do have one prepared, and it's pretty long, so stick with me. As the poet once said, where did the end of the rope go? Thank you for tuning in to our Nightfall retrospective. Stick around through the admin stuff for an Adam's ad promoting our next full campaign. At the beginning of this episode, you briefly heard the voice of Philip, our volunteer sysadmin, webmaster, tech wizard, and all-around excellent friend. Thanks for doing that bit with us, Philip. The songs in this episode, Cliffhanger Fanfare, Theme of the Dice Punks, and its acoustic version were written and recorded by the Viscount of Tempo and his element, Drew. Cover art and editing were done by Joanne, who has also appeared on the podcast now and again. Check out her work around the internet, starting with AnythingSews.com. Site design and graphics for DicePunks.com are by Robin, the player behind Lissa and Mavia, Nobilis, Fury, Madness, and The Forge. Thanks so much for listening all the way to the epilogue material of our first campaign. If you liked what you heard here in the retrospective, that's awesome all by itself, but it also means you'll probably like the episode-to-episode Dice Peaks available to our backers at the $5 level over at patreon.com/dicepunks. And if you're so inclined, there's never been a better time to help us out by rating and reviewing us wherever you listen to us, or telling your friends who you think would like us to give us a listen. We'll probably make something of a push to reach new folks as our new campaign starts up, so there's never been a more impactful time to take any of those steps. But if you prefer to just listen as you please, then we're still grateful for you. Regardless, we hope you'll tune in again for our next few smaller adventures. Till then, though, remember, subtlety is for cowards. Adam here. You may be familiar with me from such things as GMing Nightfall and awkwardly playing goth girl Radagonda and Meat Punks, but today I'm here to tell you about the next campaign I'm GMing, Hardwired Island. Do you like space? Me too! How about neon lights? Yeah, same. Cybernetics? Hell yeah, right? How do you feel about capitalism? Right, exactly, it fucking sucks. It sounds, then, like you're fully on board for Hardwired Island, a 2020 retro-future cyberpunk tabletop RPG by Paul Matijevic, Freya Erlingsdottir, and Minerva McJanda. It's a setting and system that tries to put the punk back into cyberpunk, and we here at Dice Punks are excited to bring it to you in our next full campaign. Join us on the space station metropolis of Grand Cross in the far future year of 2020 as our player characters and their neighbors battle against the corporations of the Offworld Cartel for the soul of humanity's presence in the stars. After all our cool-as-hell interstitial sessions coming up, strap on your cybernetic augments, punch a fascist in the fucking face, and dream of a future that's possible in the stars if we all fight for it together. Then, tune into Dice Punks playing Hardwired Island on a podcatcher near you.